Okay, and we're back again. I'd like to reconvene this meeting with Ruth Shapiro from the Canadian International Development Agency. A couple of announcements first. As you all know, those of you who are here in person at the meeting, this meeting is held every Thursday from 12 noon till 1:30, and this has been going for 37 years now. So for 37 years, this group has been meeting every Thursday during the year to listen to issues of importance to us, issues of importance locally, provincially, internationally. And so it's a great institution in the city. And the great thing is, too, that even if you can't make it to the meeting, you can always watch on TV. And so we'd like to welcome the Shaw Cable audience as well. And I'd like to let you know that this is aired three times over the weekend, at least three that I know of. Saturday at 12 noon. And then in the evening, I believe it's at 7 p.m., although you might want to check your TV guide over the weekend for that one. And then Sunday mornings at 8 a.m. And I understand that this is one of the most watched programs on the local Shaw station, which is Channel 12. So it's great to know that, too. Next week's topic, Thursday, October 27th, is why are young Canadian women disengaging from the political process? Why aren't young Canadian women voting? What are the factors, and can they be changed? Do young Canadian women feel left out of politics? And other questions as well, having to do with the way young Canadian women see themselves as part of the political process here in Canada. The speaker will be Melanie Thomas. Melanie has a Bachelor of Arts degree with great distinction from the University of Lethbridge and is currently studying for her Master's degree at the University of Calgary. She also ran in the last federal election. I believe it was federal, or was it provincial? Federal, in the Granham area, and so she will be the speaker next Thursday. You can also, if you get the mail-outs, great. If you don't get the mail-outs, but you're on the net, you can also find out about what programs are coming up at Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs in two places. You can go to the University of Lethbridge website and look on the notice board, but you can also go to the brand-new, bright-polished SACPA website at www.sacpa.ca, and that's on your notice today in case you've got that. You're encouraged to go to the site because there's also a spot there where you can give your feedback. Say you don't get a chance to ask the burning question that you have, or you wake up in the middle of the night tonight and think of a question you wish you'd asked Ruth, or you want to give some feedback on the topic. Yes, I'd like to see more of this kind of thing. Why don't we have such and such? Suggest speakers, suggest topics, whatever you like to do. This will be an interactive website where you can do that. So go to www.sacpa.ca, find out what's coming up in the next meetings, and also give your feedback. One other website that you can check out is also on your flyer today. It's the CETA website. You can go there to find out about the international policy statement that Ruth mentioned, about the Millennium Goals, and about other things that CETA is doing. Okay, so now at this time I'd like to invite Ruth Shapiro, who is, again, the Executive Director of the CETA Prairies Region, to come back to the podium. We will open the floor for questions, and in the usual format of Southern Alberta Council, we invite you to use the microphone at the back. Please identify yourself when you go to the microphone. Keep your questions as succinct as possible so we can get as many questions in as possible. Okay.
Welcome, Ruth. Thank you very much for coming to Lethbridge, Alberta. Where is your office, number one? And number two, what percentage of CETA's money support that's given out is in the form of food, and what portion would be, money?
In terms of our office?
I'm sorry. My name is Andy Kovacs, and I'm the executive director for the Alberta Softweed Producers Commission.
Great. In terms of our office, we are the Prairie Regional Office. We have an office in Winnipeg, one in Saskatchewan. We aren't sure if it'll be Regina or Saskatoon because we're just staffing it, and then one in Calgary and Edmonton. And we're very small offices. We're in the whole, there's also regional offices in the Atlantic and in the Pacific, and the purpose basically of those regional offices was just to try to make CETA more accessible to people and maybe able to you know, have a better opportunity to work with CETA because we're here and we can help you through the process. In terms of money, that's a harder question to answer. Our budget for this, for 2005-2006, is approximately $3.6 billion. But it's not broken down that way. Some of it goes, for example, to multilateral to World Food Program. Some of it may go to the Canadian Food Grains Bank through our partnership program. So I actually can't give you that answer, although I could get that information for you. In terms of actual food aid, it's relatively small. And in terms of actual food aid, where we're actually giving out aid as food, we've also made some changes. We're now 50% of our food aid will now be purchased overseas wherever the need is and wherever the appropriate food is and wherever it can be purchased most cheaply. As in the past, up until this year really, only 10% of our food aid was purchased overseas. So that is a change, but I would be happy to talk with you after and give you more specific information. Okay. Yeah, thank you, Will. I just realized that in trying to say everything there is to say about CETA in 20 minutes, and it's quite difficult because we're complex, I should have differentiated, and there's not time to do it now, but just do keep in mind when you're thinking about what it is the Canadian government does, that we ourselves differentiate between what we would refer to as humanitarian assistance, which is what's happening now with Pakistan, an emergency, get in there, deliver food, find shelter, get water, it's very much an emergency situation, versus long-term development, which is really our business. We want to make permanent changes. We want to contribute towards sustainable changes. So there are two different things, and we haven't had a chance to discuss it in detail, but keep that in mind. Not all of the work we do, in fact, a very small portion of the work we do is in the area of humanitarian assistance. Much more of our work is in the area of long-term development assistance.
My name is Kathy Coates, and maybe I have a question that kind of follows up on that last one. I am wondering how much of the aid that is distributed is bought locally, you know, regionally, so that the economy of the area is able to expand, and how much of that is, or how much aid is given in kind, in quotation marks. You know, we hear these stories of Canadian-made goods that are sent over so that Canadian companies get the benefit of making sales, and yet the materials are not of use.
Well, the terminology that's used in development is tied aid versus untied aid, and tied aid is basically where you purchase Canadian goods and services as part of your development assistance program. So that could include sending food, it could include sending consultants from Canada to, you know, it's called tied. Untied aid, which is the direction we're moving more in, is more and more, I mean, we're now probably, again, in percentages, I'd have to get that figure for you, but we're moving more and more in that direction, and what it basically means is, especially with the countries that we have a country of focus relationship with, we are giving them money. For example, Tanzania, we're transferring our money to them and saying, you decide, Tanzania. We've agreed in the areas, the sectors that we'll use, but you choose your own consultants, you select your own companies. They could be from anywhere in the world, including hopefully Tanzania, and it will be with Canadian dollars. So it's that's the terminology, and we're moving more and more in the direction of untied aid. But I might add, too, that that's political sometimes. Some Canadians feel that, you know, why should Canadian dollars be going to a company, a European company? Shouldn't they stay in Canada? So it's very, very difficult. But the real goal, of course, is who can deliver the best aid product and what's the best mechanism.
My name is Tim Thiessen. I want to say thanks as well, Ms. Shapiro, for your presence today. And CETA is one of the agencies of government that I could readily say that I absolutely love. So thank you for being here to share some information with us. I want to ask you to help me with some frustration, though. My frustration, following up on the last question, in 92, only 44% of our aid was tied. In 2002, it was 70%. If we're going the other direction, that's a pretty recent move. Again, that's one of my frustrations. Another frustration, our real dollar giving to least developed countries has almost halved since 1992. You talk about a budget increase up to $5 billion. We're nowhere near the 0.7% that you thankfully mentioned. And the projections are that it'll take till 2040 to get to the full 0.7%, by which time, of course, hundreds of millions more people will have died. What is the most, I know you're not the most effective, but because it's not your, really, that's not your problem. But I'm wondering if you can help me as an insider, you can give me some advice as to what is my most effective strategy and avenue to say to whoever it is that's responsible, get with the program that Canada signed as far back as 1960, the first commitment Canada made to a 0.7%. Thanks.
In terms of tide aid, I think I would, again, I'd have to double-check figures. I don't think we're anywhere near 70% of tide aid now, because 40% of our actual aid money is going through multilateral channels. And you may see that as partially, it's not really tied when it goes through multilateral channels like the UN and things. But I can get you those figures. CETA is making a real effort, and I think has done a good job, of trying to be more transparent and trying to give out statistical information. And our website has a lot of that. And I will try to get you the specific information, but it's not 70% tied. It was, it's not. In terms of what Canadians can do, how do we reach this 0.7? I can't emphasize enough the value of citizen pressure. You know, just simply citizens who care enough to raise this issue, whether it's with their members of parliament, whether it's with the government directly through our minister, whether it's as organizations who are lobbying for this. I mean, as a government, we respond to people. And a lot of that's happening now with the Make Poverty History campaign. I mean, that's going on now. I don't know how much has happened in Lethbridge, but it is sort of a national, actually, it's an international campaign. And that is about that specifically. We have to give more money to development. It has to be well spent. And the citizens care. And so I can only say that carries a lot of weight. When citizens mobilize and when they express their concerns, it's very important, and it's taken seriously at the most senior level of government. So do that. It has a great impact. And work through also the non-governmental organizations who are always working towards this goal and who make this part of their own public engagement programs usually.
My name is Mike Brown, and I'm afraid I have another question concerning money. I have read in the Globe and Mail in the last day or so and seen on TV where one of the aid agencies has complained that CETA was in fact spending far more on their aid program to Pakistan than they would have done had they worked through an aid agency. Now, since they're sending troops, our Canadian forces, to do the job, who seem to me to be very well equipped for such a thing, is it possible that the aid agencies could have done it cheaper? And perhaps you could comment on how they're working out the cost for CETA. Thank you.
Well, you're referring to the DART, the defense team called DART. And that's been certainly I follow that discussion too. I don't know that anyone could give you a definitive answer because it's very, when DART goes out, they do several things. One of the things that they do is water purification. In addition to that, they do shelter and they do medical aid. And they do a fair amount of infrastructure rehabilitation. So when they go out, they're not focusing on any one aspect. I think some of the concerns that have been expressed have been that water, as an example, could be delivered more cheaply with water purification tablets or something else. And I'm not sure if anyone has really done the analysis of the full program. Maybe water could be delivered more cheaply, but maybe water combined with the delivery of health services and infrastructure, getting in, you know, having the mobilization ability could not be done, and maybe water alone wouldn't be sufficient. I don't have an answer because this is an area of great concern, and I've read the same articles that you have about that analysis, and I'm not sure who can substantiate those figures. I think you can be sure that Canada, that the Canadian government is trying to do things in the most economical way possible. DART is a big machine. It's very hard to get operational as quickly as, say, an NGO who has an office on the ground. So it isn't there, immediately. It takes time. Whether or not in the long term it's cost effective, I mean, is going to be looked at in terms of impact after the result. But I would say only keep in mind that DART is not delivering only water purification.
Hi, Ruth. My name's Audra Poggin. I'm from the University of Lethbridge, a third-year social work student, and I'm taking a class on social justice and social policy. And within a Blackboard discussion online, I have posed the question to other classmates about Pakistan and the disaster, and just wanting to know, is Canada doing enough? What can be our contribution on an individual, a local, and a national level? And how do we know, like, within the disaster relief, that money that is spent is being spent in the best way? I think you've addressed partially that, but also like accountability and maybe possibly bureaucracy that might be involved with such an disaster relief effort. And how do we know where our dollar is going? How much of our tax dollar is involved with DART, for instance, that sort of thing?
I think if you look at what's happening in Pakistan, it's coming in from many, many different angles. The assistance is being delivered. There's money coming in through the multilateral agencies. World Health Organization is there assuming overall responsibility for the health program. The World Food Program is there. The UNDP is there. So there's the multilateral agencies which have offices in every country and are probably quite ready to become operational quickly. But at the same time, there's the non-governmental organizations, many of them also with a base in this case, Pakistan, who are actually also ready to become operational, often more at the grassroots level, not working through the government, but working through the community. And to a large degree, in the case of Pakistan also, we're seeing, especially maybe more in Toronto and places, and Vancouver in particular, the Pakistani community itself, the expat community of Pakistanis here, who are also organizing their own aid efforts to the degree that some are literally sending blankets and coats, which CETA would not normally recommend only because we think it's cheaper to purchase them there, but, you know, everyone has a different assessment of what will be useful. So I think you have to choose your agency carefully. I mean, to a large degree, it's made a little bit simpler in the sense that some organizations focus. So if, for example, you're particularly interested in health, you know, you may automatically look for an organization like Medicine Sans Frontières or Doctors Without Borders simply because that's their focus. But most, if you look at the work that most are doing, CARE, Save the Children, UNICEF, all of them, it's a mixture of shelter, food, water, health, which are the basic human needs that they're trying to meet. And I think in terms of accountability, they will all have to account for if they're to their own donors as well as to CETA who will match those dollars.
Is there a place on the website we can access that?
There is. If you go to the CETA website, which is on your announcement slip, you will see a Southeast Asia earthquake site. Go to that, and they are giving names of links to organizations raising money. And if you're thinking of donating money, of course, it's good for the organizations if you can donate it before October 26th, which is when this short-term matching program ends.
Thank you.
My name is Millie Mayberry. Thank you for coming today. Your presentation has reminded me of something that I felt very passionate about a few years ago, and it reminds me that our concern for world assistance is sort of like a diet. I mean, you get hot one time and then you fall back and forget about it. My question is, where are we in terms of canceling debt to the 40 of the world's poorest countries? Because we know it is paying back debt that is keeping poverty rampant all over the world. I'm wondering if you have any information on that.
I think you raised, two critical points. One is the canceling of debt, which Canada has been actively involved in the least developed country, and there are lists of debt agreements that have been canceled. It's happening more and more as part of the aid package. it's recognized that, you know, payment on debt can outdo any development assistance. I don't, again, I'd have to get you the specific information, or you could go to our website, but there is definitely counseling of debt in the least developed countries, and a lot of that has been happening. In terms of being a hot issue, I would say that's the biggest problem that CETA faces. When something happens in Pakistan, it's a hot issue. It hits the press, and we see what happens with the tsunamis of the world and things. But on a day-to-day basis, as African specialists have pointed out, there's a tsunami every day. People are dying every day in the same numbers of AIDS, of tuberculosis, of malaria, of malnutrition, of whatever. And that's not being paid attention to. And so the challenge for an agency like CETA is how do we get people to see that we're in it for the long term, not the short term. It's not a question of going in and delivering an emergency tents and food, and then you're out of there. That's only the beginning. But after, and even if you look at tsunami, that's very clear. The first initial phase, which has to happen, which is humanitarian, people need to have shelter, they need to have water. But after that, what happens to their livelihood? What happens to all the fishermen who no longer have a livelihood? What happens to the schools that were destroyed? So development is very long-term, and getting Canadians to be interested in the long-term and to be interested in sustainability is much more of a challenge than getting Canadians to be interested in a crisis like we're facing today.
So if I could just have another little question. I'm wondering, what group is it that decided about the 40 poorest countries? I know Canada was much a part of it, and I know that in that first year, in the heat of the situation, I think we abolished, canceled the debt of three nations. But I haven't heard anything since. Are we closer to 20 than 5?
Yes.
Maybe?
Yes, to the above. In terms of who determines it, it's based on a variety of social indicators. It's based on, the UN has a social index of, that looks at poverty, looks at access to education. And also we are part of what they call the Development Assistance Committee, the DAC. And that DAC, which is composed primarily of donors, looking at a variety of variables that have to do with access to everything from healthcare to money to water, determine which countries. There's a list of countries, most, I think, pretty well agreed to globally in terms of who are the least developed. And that information is actually probably most readily available on the UNDP website, where they have their index, and they list countries, and then within that, countries choose countries in the sense that they may have a special relationship, a special interest with some countries over others, so there's a choice within that of who any particular country chooses as their priorities, their countries of focus. But go to the UN website, the UNDP website in particular.
My name is Pat Greenlee, and I would like, I'm a little confused about how Canadian aid works, so that if the government wants, or the government has budgeted, say, this $3 billion for foreign aid, and then there are all these disasters that have come up this year, does that take some of the money away from other programs that are run on a regular basis? And I'm also wondering what Canada is doing in Guatemala, because I haven't heard anything about that.
When there's a disaster, I mean, it's unpredictable, first of all, so there's not, although the government has money available for contingency, if you want to call that, I mean, it may not be sufficient. So it could happen that long-term rehabilitation and reconstruction would come out of the aid budget, because we would have been doing that anyhow, and maybe short-term humanitarian assistance may come out of either CETA's budget or other government departments' budget. So it's not, there's not a one answer that, yes, we've said we're going to give $25 million to Pakistan, it comes out of aid. It doesn't necessarily all come out of aid. Some of it might, it depends on the nature of the activity that we're funding. In terms of Guatemala, and you're talking about the hurricane? Mm-hmm. Yes, there we are certainly involved in the hurricane. I mean, what I haven't seen, you're right, I haven't seen an announcement saying specifically what we're doing. When there's an emergency like a hurricane or an earthquake or whatever, the first point of contact really is our own embassy or high commission in that country, who with other donors identify the problem and where the need is greatest. And then what is necessary, and within that, what can Canada provide? So it's a fairly long process. I mean, we are definitely giving money to SAM. I don't have the dollar figure, but it's not, the fact that it's not getting the same level of attention does not mean it's not getting the aid. It is. But I don't have dollar figures for you.
My name is Terry Shillington. Thank you for coming and for sharing some of this information with us. I'd like to ask a question that I hear asked around me a lot, and that is kind of the grumpy question, how much of our aid really gets there and how much of it is wasted? And I heard you say that you select countries with good government, and yet I'm guessing that there's probably still some wheels of officialdom that need to be greased, and at least that's the suspicion around that, how much really gets to and how much is spent in, greasing the wheels? And do you care to speak to that, allay some suspicion or make some confessions or whatever it is?
It's a very good question. I would say in terms of when we're trying to get Canadians to be more involved, more interested in development cooperation, that's the first question that comes up. How do we even know how much of our money is going to go to the country and for what, how it will be used? Canada as a country, of course, has an anti-corruption act. Our companies, our government cannot legally, for sure, deliver any bribes or anything else. I mean, there is an act, and companies have actually been fined for it. And CETA has, in some cases, stopped funding some companies who were accused or found guilty of bribery. So it's not something that is done openly. It's probably the hardest thing to get a handle on in terms of what happens on a project-by-project basis. What is corruption? I've heard non-governmental organizations tell me that they've had to give away bags of cement, that's what they've had to give away. It's maybe worth $50. It's very hard. I mean, that's never going to be accounted for. But I would say that in terms of policy, it's not a Canadian private sector companies have actually complained and said it's made them less competitive in some cases because they're not in the position to offer, if not, they would never call it bribes, but sort of extra, they cannot do that as part of working with government funds. So I think in terms of internally within our own operation, we estimate that we spend around 6 to 7% on our own administrative costs, so we try to certainly keep our own administration low. But we have fairly, I would say, CETA has really quite good accountability measures. Things are audited, things are evaluated on a regular basis. People have to report on their disbursements. They have to report on their results. So I think that, CETA and government generally does everything it can to ensure accountability. Whether it's 100% successful, I would never venture to guess. But I mean, I know that in terms of we're criticized quite often by people working with us that we are so bureaucratic in terms of accountability that we make it difficult for people to work with us. And that's the other side of the coin. To get that accountability is bureaucratic. But we do insist on it. I'll leave that to you.
Thank you very much for your presentation today. Art Sanford's my name, and I did have the pleasure about 15 years ago of going on a CETA trip to South America for a development project, and it's worked out very well. I think it's continuing to this day. But I do have a couple of questions. First of all, CETA, was it always development and doing the charitable side of things from day one, or is that something that's been added in lately? And the other question is, when you talk about 0.7% of GDP,
Zero point seven.
Is that both sides of the project? That includes the total project.
CETA, since its inception as a separate government agency, I mean, there was always foreign aid delivered through the Commonwealth, through various other programs, but CETA as an agency has always had two sides to it. It's always had the bilateral, which is the government-to-government, and the partnership, which is working with NGOs and other charitable organizations. So it was developed that way. And in terms of the 0.7%, that is overall. That's our whole budget. That would be for everything. If you look at our budget, it's divided between various sectors. Money we give to the private sector, money we give to UN agencies, money we give through direct geographic bilateral programs, money we give to charitable organizations. Like, there's several different ways of delivering money, but all of it would be included in the 0.7%.
Okay, and the other question I had, and I think Terry stole most of it, though, was being from the business community, I'm very concerned about value for money. And you're dealing with some very corrupt governments around the world, and which you must do because the need is there. And I'm quite concerned about how you do your follow-up. And do you have people on the ground, and is the law when you give the money, they must follow up and give you a proper accounting of how it was spent?
Well, partially we work through partners. So, for example, your business. Say you came to our CETA Industrial Cooperation Program and we funded you to do a project in Nigeria or something. It would be, the onus would be on you to be accountable for the use of those funds. So you would be working with your Nigerian partner, if that was as an example. If it's government to government, then of course it's audits. Everything is audited. There's audited financial statements required every year. I mean, it's a fairly traditional, I think, quite...